The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report, sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us now is Dr. Jim Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of the world's leading experts on cyber and all things related. Jim, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you and good morning.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is brought to you by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Jim, it's been a couple of months since Russia's SolarWinds attack was revealed. Then we had China's Hafnium cyber unit use Microsoft to execute what could be an even more, even bigger and wider and worse penetration. Like SolarWinds, you know, it's kind of an all hands on deck approach. Clearly, we have vulnerabilities in the supply chain, as we heard from the NSA director, General Nakasone, and the administration is working on an executive order. But clearly, it's time for a new strategy. Jim Stavridis, says that we're at a cyber war. He calls it a shadow cyber war. Some people would disagree. They would say we are at cyber war with China, which is something the former Marine Commandant General Neller used to talk about all the time. What does the response of this administration need to look like? And what is the new approach we need for the future? Because we keep saying, okay, we want to prevent the next attack. You know, if you go back and you read the Solarium report, we've had multiple, not quite 9/11, but pretty bad incidents. And we're moving, but not quite fast enough.
So the administration's off to a good start, but they've got some hard problems. First is on the domestic side, you've got, how do you get companies to do a better job of protecting themselves? And how do you get agencies to do all the things we thought they would do after OPM in 2015? Turns out most of them haven't done anything. So I think a lot of the focus will be on the domestic side. How do you improve our defenses? But people realize that's not enough. And that's where we're getting into a debate. The old strategy doesn't work. People grudgingly admit that because they just love saying deterrence. Deterrence. We haven't deterred anything. Give me a break. And so what takes the place of deterrence? The U.S. is groping towards a new cyber strategy. It'll be a debate, right? Because there's people who are hand-wringers. There's people who are, you know, people say, well, the Russians will do something mean back to us. And it's like, you mean in addition to every mean thing they've done before? So we are in this debate about what takes the place of the old Cold War-derived strategy. And the administration's on a good start. The ideas that are being talked about for the executive order are the right ones. You know, improve federal performance, improve federal organization, improve the software supply chain. Exactly right. But the larger question of domestic measures are not enough. We all sort of recognize that. We're going to have to do something back to the Russians and the Chinese to get them to change their behavior. And that's where the debate is now.
Like anything, you need the offensive part of it. You need the defensive part of it, right? Nicole Perlroth in her book, I think rather smartly, and I think, you know, that's what you're alluding to. It was about, you know, be muscular, be offensive. And that'll somehow change the dynamic. And actually, we may not have invested as much in defensive capabilities. You also need global norms, right? Every single interview we've done, whether it's with you or Mike Rogers or Chris Inglis or Suzanne, your colleague, Suzanne Spaulding, Chris Krebs, right? Everybody has talked about the importance of sort of better rules of the road because this is sort of a little bit of a Wild West. How?
No, it's not. No, stop there. It's not. In 2015, I was an advisor to the UN and we got global agreement on 11 norms for responsible state behavior. That agreement was just reaffirmed by all UN member states in something called the Open-Ended Working Group, the OEWG. We have the rules. The problem is that there's people who don't feel bound by them. So it's not a Wild West. It's not that there aren't norms. There are norms. How do you get two countries in particular? They begin with the letters R and C. How do you get those countries to observe the norms? And I think wringing your hands or sending them a nasty note or even some more sanctions isn't going to do it. So that's the fundamental strategic problem. We have norms. There's global agreement on them. But without some kind of mechanism to impose consequences when states fail to observe those norms, they'll be hollow. Now, norms are useful. They give us a framework and a legitimacy to actually do things back, to actually take responses and impose consequences. So the norms are very valuable, but they are not going to be observed by two countries in particular until we do something to make it a little costly to fail to observe them.
Is the Jim, the two pieces of this, right? I mean, the notion that we need a national cyber director is important. It's terrific that Ann Neuberger, who's a generational talent, moved from NSA over to the White House to be on the staff, you know, in a key cyber role. All eyes are on who's going to become the national cyber director. A lot of very, very good talent that's been under consideration. But we're 80 days into the new administration, two major cyber incidents ultimately, and concerns about how that will work, right? I mean, at the end of the day, people are always worried about losing authority. I remember when Department of Homeland Security was created and people at the Pentagon at the time were lamenting about how they were going to have another big mouth competing for resources and that ultimately it would be bad for the Pentagon budget, as opposed to looking at it and saying, hey, this was good to give shape and organization to a lot of government agencies that were not as well organized as they should be. What's, no matter who is picked for this role, what are the keys to making it successful, right? Because in Washington, you also often find bureaucratic infighting undoes really important initiatives.
So the creation of CISA a few years ago was probably one of the most important steps for better cybersecurity, not internationally, not militarily, but CISA is a big improvement. It needs work. It needs resources. One thing to think about is why not make the director of CISA the national cyber coordinator? I say that because Congress, you know, in their helpful way, looked at the Trump administration, saw that it had eliminated the cyber coordinator and decided to fix that. That was good. But being Congress, they couldn't help themselves. First, they made it a Senate-confirmed position. And second, they didn't think about what a new administration would do if it wasn't Trump. So you've created a situation of diffusion of authority. You've created a real problem. Congress always wants White House positions to be confirmed. They've been trying this probably since 1947. It's a bad idea. Telling administrations how to organize themselves and telling presidents who should be in their cabinet, that's not Congress's role. That's not what they're supposed to be doing. And in this case, if you're a congressionally appointed national cyber director, your records are available for scrutiny in a way that White House records are shielded. So you've created an immediate problem right there. You can't dual hat Ann Neuberger because she would need two systems, one closed to protect the president, one open to meet Congress's demands. This was just not a helpful thing. And so a couple suggestions are, is there someplace you can dual hat it? You can't dual hat it to Ann because of the effect on the White House record keeping. Maybe you can dual hat it to CISA. That's already a Senate confirmed position. A third option, of course, is there's a lot of nice office space up near Union Market on New York Avenue. And I think that would be a great location. That's usually what happens when you're a drug czar or an intellectual property czar. You kind of migrate to the fringes of Washington. Maybe not what we need to do, probably not a good idea, but Congress has created this mess. They should think of a way to get out of it. And a congressionally mandated national cyber director is not what we need.
And so you think the current, with the right kind of empowerment from the president, the existing organizations can do that, especially if you can coordinate this right, at the Office of Management and Budget. I mean, that's, you know, some cyber experts lamented Neera Tanden's political demise as being problematic because they thought she really got cyber. From your standpoint, if the president and his staff are engaged enough, you think the other, you get the organization without that?
Well, Michael Daniel remains a great precedent because he came out of OMB. He knew the budget process. He knew the budget for the intelligence community. He really put his stamp on the organization of cybersecurity in the U.S. And part of the reason for congressional action was the Trump administration's dismantling of the things he had helped build. You've got this issue now, which is, should cyber be a standalone agency? Some people have talked about a USTR for cyber. I myself said that 10 years ago. The problem is cyber is slowly getting incorporated into everything. Big agencies are not going to accept an external body giving them direction unless it's the White House. And so I think we've created unintentionally a real mess, right?
Right.
DHS, CISA can look at the small agencies. The big agencies need to be better coordinated, but the only person they're going to pay attention to is the president. How do we get out of this mess? Appointing a national cyber director, you can go in with the best will in the world, and many of the candidates for this job have that, but there's unavoidable tensions with the NSC staff and the NCD that probably won't help. So we've once again, with all the best motives in the world, we've managed to dig ourselves into a hole.
And how do we dig ourselves out?
You know, one way would be for Congress to repeal this. That's probably too bold for them. Another way is to find a safe dual hatting where the record keeping requirements aren't as much of an impediment. That points to the director of CISA. I think those are the solutions. I don't remember, but when they created this position, did they put any money next to it? I mean, that's one of the dilemmas with putting this at the White House is you've got about a dozen people doing cyber there now, and some of them will have to be siphoned off to do support the new director, national cyber director. It's already a bit of a problem with, they have Michael Sulmeier as the Michael Daniel equivalent, and he's had to have people go to support Anne. They need to pour more bodies into cyber, and they need to pour more money into cyber. That would be a good start, but you know, don't build in conflicts, and creating two heads is never a good idea. I'm just not a big fan of Congress telling the White House how to organize itself. I mean, every president since Truman has resisted that.
It's very interesting. I mean, for people who understand Washington well, the bipartisan consensus has always been, right, it's advise and consent on the part of Congress. And ultimately, unless the person, you know, as long as the person is not corrupt and not manifestly incompetent, and the president wants that person, you should have that person do it in the spirit that the president would be presumably picking people who are qualified for jobs. Let me take you to the question of the infrastructure measure that the president is putting forward. A little bit north of $2 trillion. A lot of negotiation will be ongoing, about $650 billion for roads and what have you. And obviously, there is a need for national infrastructure investment. Indeed, there's a need for national technological investment. And so in some quarters, this is very, very welcome because it has been decades since we've done something like this. I think people have a tendency of forgetting the interstate highway system was a national security project, ultimately, and an investment in American competitiveness, just like going to the moon or the space program. All were things to advance American technology at the Cold War. We did that with microelectronics, for example, when we felt like we were losing the lead to the Japanese. How important a role does cyber need to play with this? Because we have a tendency of sort of thinking about infrastructure as sort of roads and airports and the physical infrastructure, as opposed to actually cyber, which is absolutely critical to literally everything we do. As you said, right, it's not a separate and apart thing. it's integrated to everything we do. How do we need to think about cyber in an infrastructure standpoint?
You know, the bill is long overdue, as you said. In the Clinton administration, the Congress decided to cut federal funding. And so that's why we have third world infrastructure in so many places in the US. And it would be good to fix that. The support for R&D, another decision in the 90s by Congress and the White House, was a huge mistake to cut R&D spending. So plussing that up, long overdue. You're not going to beat China by wishful thinking. You're going to have to spend money. Where cyber fits into this is more on the issue of research and development, of broadband, and of 5G. Now, 5G is one of those shiny object terms that people throw around in Washington. I'm as guilty as anyone, but 5G is not a telecom network. It's a new kind of internet. And because you'll have increased computing power, because you'll move intelligence to the edge of the network, accelerating deployment of 5G is a way to, if you do it right, improve cybersecurity. So that's the infrastructure, the network infrastructure that the bill at least talks about, the proposal, I beg your pardon, talks about. That's an opportunity for us to use new technologies to make American networks more secure.
I've said this on this show, and so I apologize for those listeners who think that I'm getting a little bit target fixated on this, but literally one of the best single Washington events I have ever attended was your conversation with Hartmut Nevin, who led the Google Quantum Supremacy team a little over a year ago. It was in January 2020, and commend anybody to go and listen to that online, because I know that it resides online. And what Hartmut was saying was the vital importance for the nation. This was coming from the man who led the team to achieve quantum supremacy, right? The ability to do a complex calculation in about 100 seconds that a linear computer would need 10,000 years to solve. And his urgent warning that we need some form of national approach to this because the Chinese are really focused. You know, as he said, like, I'm Google and I got a lot of money. The Chinese have more money than I have. And oh, by the way, the guy who leads the Chinese program, we have the same PhD advisor. So this guy is good, really good. And we've seen over the past year, the Chinese fielding quantum communications capabilities and the like. What in the context of this, are people taking quantum as seriously as they need to be taking it? And do we need to have a national, because it doesn't seem to me, Jim, we don't have a national data strategy. We don't have a national cyber strategy. You know what I mean? And all of this stuff shouldn't really be left to chance, right?
Well, I think some of the actions you're seeing in the Biden administration and on the Hill, like the Eternal Frontiers Act, is that what it is? I think it is. People have figured out that we're in a competition with China that will require us to spend money on R&D. Quantum is one of those areas, but there's a whole set of emerging technologies where, as you pointed out in the beginning, federal investment is essential if we're going to keep up. And this year, by some measures, for the first time, China outspent the US in R&D. They looked at us, they studied us and what we did in the 70s and 80s in the Cold War, our model of using R&D for national security, and they copied it. It's with Chinese characteristics, of course, which gives us an advantage. But we're being beaten at our own game, and it's because of an unwillingness to spend money. And if you look at the CHIPS Act, is it funded yet? I don't think so. Maybe it'll get funded in some of these relief measures, but we need a national approach to reinforce R&D. We need a national approach to put science and research back at the center of our funding priorities. I think we're on a path to do that. So I'm moderately optimistic. It maybe has taken a little longer than you could hope, but we're on the right path.
And you were right. It was the Endless Frontiers Act.
I say Eternal Frontier?
That's you may have said name, eternal. It is. It's but that sounds like a cemetery a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, Pet Frontiers. Cemetery. Yeah.
Eternal Frontiers.
Okay, sorry, I was wrong.
No. That's not what I'm saying. So let me just take you briefly, because there were two other questions I want to ask you, but let me just briefly put this to you, right? That you know, for many in Washington, it's increasingly becoming a little bit like it was during the Cold War, right? How the Chinese characteristics are the important part of it, right? That China has this right, whereas you're somewhat more skeptical that China has it right, right? So what do you think remain the U.S. advantages, because there are those who look at us and actually see the division, the lack of, as Bill Maher, I think, really, really nailed it. I mean, right, a million commentators could be writing that, but Bill Maher is sort of saying, like, we just don't really do things well anymore. And that's the fundamental problem, right? It was interesting that that monologue came about a week after Adam Smith said that, right? We're the country that everybody looks to do things right the first time out. From your standpoint, do we still have advantages over the Chinese system? And if what are they?
No, I worry about that, because we spend the most on healthcare, and yet we rank, I think, about 26th in the world. We spend the most on education. We're definitely not at the top. We spend a lot of money on things, and we don't do well. So there's something wrong in the, we spend a lot of money on bringing democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that one hasn't played out as much. We spent more than the GDP of most countries. So we've got this problem, you know, and so I wonder that, is there an American disease where we're not as competent? But what I'd remind people, and if you've heard me say this before, I apologize, but in the 70s, we had a similar situation that we had. We were just coming out of a weak presidency. We were coming out of losing a large war. We had the oil crisis. We had stagflation. We were a mess. And so the Soviets announced that the correlation of forces had shifted irrevocably to the socialist camp, right? That they had won, right? And that capitalism and democracy had failed. And 10 years after they said that, we knew what the answer was. No, it works. What you need is leadership, you need commitment, and you need focus. And that sounds like something your football coach would say to you before a big game. But honestly, if we get the right leadership, and I'm really, this sounds partisan, I don't mean it to be, the Biden administration is off to a great start. If they can keep it up, if Congress is supportive, we can repeat the successes that Ronald Reagan had. I'm really confident of that. So yeah, it's going to be a messy couple of years, and there's some tough issues, mainly social issues, that we're going to have to deal with. But in the long term, let's not exaggerate China's strengths. The Chinese have one advantage in addition to being willing to spend, and that is that they have complete control over the news cycle. And so when you get a number from China, you should immediately divide it by into threes and figure they're exaggerating. So they exaggerate their prowess. Our problems are on the front page for everyone to see. Maybe that's not a good predictor, though. We do have problems. I mean, how do we spend so much on things and yet not seem to get the results that anyone would want? I think we can fix that. So not something we can fix in a year, but in general, the correlation of forces has not shifted to the socialist camp. Xi Jinping, start drawing up those retirement plans.
I second that in many respects. And also, right, I mean, the Chinese also really understand the magnitude of the challenges and problems that they have, right? I mean, the average Chinese is not particularly crazy that the whole nation is slewing toward an authoritarian bent, right? The Chinese had a good balance between what they want from the state, what they don't. But basically, it was very free market. Once you start jailing the Jack Ma's, right, the other really smart Jack Ma's in the ecosystem go, I'm not sure I want to do this if the state can take everything away from me and, oh, by the way, jail me. Let me take you to two.
Let me just say real quick.
Go ahead. Sure.
We owe Xi Jinping a vote of thanks, because China would be a much more formidable competitor if he wasn't going around nipping off the innovators. right? So right. We would be a much tougher fight if it was the China of, say, 10 years ago.
I think it was interesting that Bob Work, he joined us last week to discuss the AI report. And one of the points he made was, hey, why don't we get those really smart Chinese kids to come here and to stay here and to contribute to our ecosystem and our national security, right? I mean, do proper vetting. But at the end of the day, that's the strength of the United States, right? Our system is fundamentally better. It's fairer, it's more transparent.
The only dilemma is I've been hearing that for 20 years. You know, every PhD should come with a green card attached. And in 20 years, we haven't been able to make it work. That's not Donald Trump. That's something else. So great idea. As we enter the third decade of trying to pull it off, keep me posted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, my little pushback to that was you could be really good, really smart Chinese, come to the United States and want to go home for patriotic reasons and apply that know-how to your home country, which is what happens often, whether it's an Indian student, a Chinese student, Middle Eastern students, right? I mean, they come, they study, they educate, they get their PhD, they start a business, and then they move home. That doesn't mean you don't give it the college try. Let me ask you really quickly two questions. DoD is reviewing the CMMC, the Cyber Maturity Model Certification process that began under the last administration. Widespread acceptance that it was kind of a good approach to very quickly get a handle on supply chain surety. It's encountered a couple of challenges. It's now facing an internal review. What does CMMC or son of CMMC need to look like, Jim?
CMMC was a great idea. It's good that they did it, but we found two problems that shouldn't be a big surprise. The first is the process is slow and cumbersome. The second is it's expensive. So those are easy targets for DoD to fix. You know, having outside validators, outside certifiers could be a problem. So how do they streamline CMMC and make it less expensive for countries to companies to participate in? I think the EO will address some of that. I'm not sure. I don't know if it has the word CMMC in it, but that's what they need to focus on, streamlining cost.
And what are the broad contours of the EO as you understand them at this point, right? I mean, what are the different, because it is wide ranging every week. It's one more week. Now we hear it's either next week or the week after, but that's not necessarily all that different. What should folks generally expect? And I don't want you to be giving anything away here in the event
that you've been
consulted, right? But what should folks look to seeing from this? Because it is going to be extraordinarily comprehensive.
Not to give them a plug, but I'd really love to know who it is that talked to Joe Mann at Reuters, because a lot of people point to his story on the EO. It has three parts. The first part is reorganizing the federal government. This is basically undoing the damage done by the Trump administration. It's one of the reasons why the solarium recommendations aren't necessary, right? Part two is creating standards for best practices in federal agencies. I think that what I've been told is that, you know, after OPM 5 years ago, there were a lot of measures that people were supposed to take and most of them didn't. So getting federal agencies to observe best practices would be good. The third part is looking at the software supply chain as it affects the federal government. And I think that's where there might be some parallels to CMMC, but you know, it's a draft, it could change, but I think those are the three broad parts, organization, best practices for agencies, and federal supply chain.
We'd love to have you back once it's released to kind of go through it and get your take on all of that. Very briefly, we've got about 30 seconds left. Talk to us a little bit about this spate of ransomware attacks, really unprecedented, getting through very, very tough security, much tougher security than we've had in the past. These things do come in waves. They've affected major cities like Baltimore, which had to, you know, refuse to pay ransoms and scrapped a lot of data that was never unlocked. How do we need to think about that problem as well? Because it looks like it's hitting a very large swath of folks.
this points to the larger trend in cybersecurity strategy, because many countries, many of our allies now think ransomware is a national security problem that needs to be tackled. And what some of them say is, why do we let these people operate? We know the infrastructure that they use. We could go after it. So I think a more assertive, a more coercive cyber policy to go after the places that engage in ransomware and make it hard for them to do business is the way to go. We've done that with botnets. It worked pretty well. Now it's time to do it with ransomware.
Jim, always an honor and pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time, and already looking forward to having you back on again. Thanks a lot.
This was fun. Thank you. I love being on this show.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.